Well, thank you very much, Father Dominic. And I'd like to thank all the Dominicans for their kind hospitality, kind invitation to this conference. It's a great pleasure and an honor for me to be here with you. And as Father Dominic mentioned, I know that I owe this invitation to this little book published in 2014, The Servant and the Ladder, Cooperation with Evil in the 21st Century. And the text was essentially completed in 2009 as my dissertation at the Pontifical Regina Apostolorum University in Rome. And in this intervening nearly decade, I've had various opportunities to present my understanding of the matter and to try to clarify more precisely, also for myself, the key issue at stake as I see it. So in this talk, after briefly summarizing what I sought to do in the book, I'll draw out some of the elements which concern the specific question of intention, hence the title of the presentation, A Closer Look at Intention, What Exactly is the Cooperator Doing? And finally, since I certainly didn't claim to have resolved all the various problems that seem to open up, I'll try to indicate some additional steps forward beyond what I already ventured in the book. As we know, since the days of St. Alphonsus Liguori, Catholic theology has made a fundamental distinction in the analysis of cooperation with evil between formal and material cooperation. The formal cooperator shares the bad intention of the principal agent, while the material cooperator does not. This latter would merely foresee that his cooperation will serve the principal agent in some way, but this unfortunate consequence is praeter intentionem, beyond his, the cooperator's, intention. I considered this established doctrine, but was concerned with the problem of identifying when, in fact, the cooperator shares the intention of the principal agent. A question which often does not seem so very clear. Typically, doubt arises in cases of reluctant cooperation, or cooperation in which some element of duress is present. It seemed to me that very little of this cooperation is ever considered formal, and that consequently a large category of what some have called implicitly formal cooperation is being overlooked, categorized instead as material. And this would, of course, have serious ramifications, as formal cooperation cannot be undertaken for any reason, while material cooperation can be given under certain conditions. So an example which serves to illustrate the question and which gave my book its title is the case which vexed St. Alphonsus and many others, that of the servant and the ladder. In 1679, Blessed Pope Innocent XI rejected the idea that a servant who feared, quote, notable harm, such as being maltreated or fired, could, without mortal sin, help his master to climb through the window of a girl in order to violate her virginity. The Pope rejected, as laxist, the idea that the servant could help, without mortal sin, in order to avoid these anticipated punishments. Now, the condemnation of this proposition led various authors to conclude that the assistance requested of the servant would necessarily involve him in doing evil, and that he could therefore never consent even to save his life. Holding the latter would be, in effect, intrinsically evil. St. Alphonsus, after initially accepting this view, argued instead that the servant was not actually doing anything evil when he held the latter, and that the foreseen abuse of his service by the master would not alter the nature of his action. St. Alphonsus dubbed the servant's cooperation material and allowed that it could be given without mortal sin for more serious reasons than the merely notable harm mentioned in the proposition. His view became the more common one, but voices holding that such cooperation was formal never disappeared altogether. So what is the servant intending when he holds the ladder? That is the question. In the bulk of my study, I sought, with the help of Elizabeth Ann Scombe and post-Veritatis Splendor thinkers, especially Stephen Long, to argue that the servant could not deny intending harm to the virgin if he held the ladder, knowing what the master proposed to do. I considered the term implicitly formal cooperation very apt to describe such cooperation, which of its nature implies a bad intention, that is, cooperation whose object or finis operis is bad, even if the cooperator has a laudable further intention or finis operandis. This view would move a very large part of cooperation cases from the material category to the formal, with significant practical consequences. The balance of my book was devoted to arguing that this would not be an intolerable result, but one which, on the contrary, might actually lead in the direction of reversing the culture of death. So much for the brief summary. Let us return to the key question: what is the servant intending when he holds the ladder? Now, the more common response, which takes its cue from St. Alphonsus, would deny that the servant necessarily intends harm to the victim when he consents to holding the ladder. This view is based on the very reasonable idea that one is said to intend only that which one seeks as an end or as a means to that end. The servant may abhor the end of the master, having as his own end simply the preservation of his job or life. In fact, in cases of duress, the very presence of duress indicates that the cooperator does not have the same goal as the principal agent, for if he did, coercion would not be necessary. The whole question then becomes that of deciding whether the harm to the virgin is necessarily intended by the servant as a means to his good end of self-preservation. At this point, it might be helpful to look at Germain Griset, may God reward him for his life of faithful service, who claims to distinguish, quote, formal from material cooperation precisely as Alphonsus did, end quote. Griset explicates the notion of means by saying that cooperation will be formal also when, quote, one's proposal includes the other's successfully carrying out an objectively wrong choice, end quote. If the successful completion of the principal agent's evil project is necessary for the cooperator to attain his own end, benign as it may be, the cooperator will not be able to deny formal cooperation. For example, let us suppose that a secretary is asked to cooperate in an embezzlement and in return is promised 10% of the proceeds. She may wish to have this money only for the purpose of paying for an operation for her grandmother, a worthy end. However, as it will be necessary for the crime to come off in order for her to get her share of the proceeds, Griset would call this formal cooperation, and rightly so. However, let us suppose that the secretary agrees to cooperate, but only on condition that she be paid up front. It is now a matter of indifference to her whether or not the embezzlement scheme succeed, for she already has her cut. Would one really wish to say that the nature of her cooperation has now changed from formal to material? I think the answer is clearly no. In the context of the servant and the ladder, this would seem to indicate that the actual success of the master's evil plan should not be required for the servant's cooperation to count as formal. He may receive his benefit, that is, the preservation of his health or job, even if the plan fail, but that is no guarantee of merely material cooperation. Even if the servant hold the ladder, hoping all the while that, for instance, the master be unable to open the window, or the girl happen to be out, this would seem only to indicate that he really doesn't share the master's evil end. It may be, however, that helping to harm the girl is still a means for the servant to obtain his own good end. Now, this may sound a bit excessive. Is it really correct to say that the violation of the virgin, which, as we noted, may not actually occur, is a means that the servant cannot deny intending in order to preserve his job? Once again, Griset would say no. He maintains, quote, to intend something is either to aim at it, as at one's precise purpose in acting, or to embrace it for its positive contribution to the achievement of that purpose, end quote. He provides the following illustration. Quote, I realize that the drapery will fade if I close it against the sun, but I do not intend its fading, end quote. Now, certainly the fading does not make any positive contribution to the agent's goal. And if by some miracle the curtains do not fade, this would not upset the agent's plan. For Griset, whatever happens to them is therefore outside his intention. But is it? Obviously, the agent's goal in drawing the curtains is not to make them fade, but only to prevent the sun from damaging the furniture or blinding the inhabitants. The fading of the curtains is not his finis operantis. Nonetheless, someone aware of the effect that keeping the curtains drawn will eventually produce must say, in effect, let the curtains fade. It's worth it to save the furniture. It is surely not so far-fetched to claim that he intends the ruination of the curtains in some sense as a means to the preservation of the furniture, even though it is not the ruination per se that saves the furniture. Under the circumstances, one would naturally say that there is no other way or means to save the furniture than by sacrificing the curtains. Again, in my view, this is the central point in the question of cooperation with evil. It is also the most controversial one. So it was not surprising that one reviewer, a well-known ethicist in England, zeroed in on it in her review of my book. I quote, "So willing is Cummings, at least sometimes, to impute intention from foreknowledge that he even says at one point that someone who draws the curtains to keep out the sun intends that they fade." Exclamation point. However, intention, as we normally use the term, is about our actual goals, our choice of ends and means, rather than about states of the external world, however important these are in providing choice-worthy options, end quote. She suggests that I would, quote, sometimes stretch the definition of intention to breaking point, end quote, in the effort to exclude forms of cooperation that should be avoided. But is this really stretching the definition of intention, or is it highlighting the concept's easily overlooked borders? The just-cited reviewer herself admits intention as we normally use the term is about our actual goals. This certainly is true. Such is the normal use of the word, and what one author calls the paradigmatic use. But is there not a secondary sense of intention that needs to be acknowledged? What if, in the example of the curtains, they belong to someone else who came in one day to find his curtains completely faded? Should he accuse you of selfishly ruining his curtains to save the fabric on your furniture, you couldn't very well respond, "I didn't intend to ruin them. I only foresaw their ruination." Admittedly, those who, like my critic, insist that the damage to the curtains is only foreseen, do not for that reason think that it can be permitted for any reason. They maintain that one is still responsible for foreseen harms, which one somehow causes. But how can we blame someone for something, like ruining the curtains, if it's in no way intended? The intention-foresight distinction, then, so characteristic of Catholic moral theology, is real and important. There seems to be, however, another distinction needing to be made within the concept of intention to prevent too many consequences from being labeled mere side effects. This distinction is not really new at all. In recent moral philosophy, it has been given the name oblique intention, drawing upon Jeremy Bentham, but also indirect intention, or simply intentional, in contrast to intended. Many authors perceive that directly caused effects must be distinguished, even when they are undesired, from mere side effects. Or to put it another way, the set of consequences that are intended, as we normally use the word, and those that are unintended, do not cover the whole range of consequences. As the example of the curtains shows, this category of intention is not mysterious or rare, but very commonplace. One text of St. Thomas in which he approaches this issue is in his commentary on Aristotle's Books of Physics. There, the angelic doctor affirms, quote, It is stupid to say that someone intends something and does not want that which frequently or always is joined to it, end quote. So this would seem to mean that the servant cannot intend to hold the ladder and deny wanting, velit, harm to come to the girl. Yet St. Thomas soon adds, quote, if someone frequently or always dirties his feet when he goes to a muddy place, and although he may not intend this, still it is not said to occur by chance, end quote. This would seem to indicate that if the harm to the girl, which would frequently or always ensue from the servant's assistance, is not intended in the normal sense of the term, neither can it be treated as something for which I am not responsible, as if it occurred by chance. Stephen Brock, commenting on this passage, affirms, quote, what Aquinas means is that although he does not intend simply to get his feet wet, this still falls under his intention, end quote. So once again, we have consequences which we want to call intentional, but not intended. The important point for our effort to hone the concept of formal cooperation is that acts which are normally called praeter intentionem, like getting one's feet wet or fading curtains, are also intentional. It's not obvious, therefore, that they should qualify as material cooperation. A similar example, which has been discussed since the time of Aristotle, is that of the merchant who throws his cargo into the sea to save his boat. The ruination of his goods is obviously intentional. It does not happen by chance. And yet Thomas will call it, understandably enough, praeter intentionem. Brock calls the destruction of the goods indirectly intended. Quote, this is not something that the sailor is intending or trying to bring about except indirectly. This is important because it means that results not directly intended can be counted as falling somehow under one's intention, even if one is not culpable for them. End quote. Stephen Long, it seems to me, provides the key to unraveling the problem. This might be a little review, I hope correct. He explains convincingly that the term intention, as used by St. Thomas, primarily refers to the end at which the agent aims, but applies to the means in a, quote, wholly secondary, derived, and analogical way, end quote. He continues, intention is not indifferently to be used, then, of end and means, and the more proper term is choice with respect to means, end quote. Long underlines the importance of determining whether the means chosen is naturally ordered to the intended end. When the means chosen is per se ordered to the end, as in the case of the merchant jettisoning the goods, then this action is subsumed under the intention of saving the ship, making a single simple act. One could imagine a different scenario, where, for instance, the sailor was asked to turn over a passenger to pirates, who were threatening, in the case of refusal, to sink the ship. Regardless of the ethical analysis one makes, it is no longer possible to consider this a simple act. There is no per se ordination between the means chosen and the end of saving the ship. Now the sailor would have to commit what Long calls a complex act, composed of a simple act, giving up the passenger, united accidentally to the further intention or motive of saving his ship. To reinforce the point, we may recall the famous Article 7 of question 64 of the Secunda Secundae of the Summa about self-defense. According to this interpretation, found also in Gregory Reichberg, it is possible to choose a lethal form of defense, aware that it will frequently or always result in the death of the attacker without intending his death, provided that the means chosen is per se ordered to this end. However, as Thomas's reply to objection 4 points out, committing adultery in order to preserve one's life would be a different story. Adultery is not of its nature ordered to the defense of life, and so it must be intended in the primary, normal sense, and accidentally ordered to the end of self-defense. For this reason, it is forbidden as a case of doing evil that good may come. Let us underline now the benefit, the great benefit, of this analysis. It refuses to claim that the killing of the assailant or the ruination of the cargo is completely outside the intention. Rather, there is the frank admission that it is chosen as a means and so falls under the intention, but in a completely secondary manner that permits the primary intention, the end sought, to specify the act. This is different from those authors who can only justify these actions by separating, implausibly in my view, the undesired consequences from the means chosen. This approach has been criticized since the days of Pascal as directing one's intention. Thus, the merchant would have to intend only to throw the cargo overboard, but not to get it wet or ruined. The person who has only a powerful handgun and one chance to use it could intend only to shoot his attacker point blank, but not to kill him. It is as if mental effort alone, directing one's intention, can determine the morality of the choice to pull the trigger. I tried to apply this line of reasoning to the question of cooperation. Essentially, the claim that the servant is cooperating materially would require that he direct his intention. He does something which frequently or always has the result of bringing harm to the innocent girl, but as long as he intend only the holding of the ladder, as the sailor would intend only the getting the cargo off the boat, he would not need to intend in any sense the negative consequence. The position of Long and Reichberg, on the other hand, would say no. Holding the ladder is like throwing the cargo overboard, and the harm that ensues to the Virgin is like the ruination of the goods when they hit the water. One cannot separate these realities with our minds. Rather, we must ask, can we legitimately choose them? The answer for these authors will depend upon the per se ordination of the object of choice to the end sought. The result for the servant is clear. He cannot claim to be choosing something which of its nature is ordered to saving his life or job. Rather, he would be committing a complex act with the finis operantis of avoiding punishment. The morality of holding the ladder must be evaluated on its own, apart from its value in avoiding punishment. Just as the morality of adultery had to be evaluated on its own, not as an act of self-defense. If holding the ladder were something that the servant would do anyway, regardless of the evil end the master has in mind, then it could be justified. This would be a case of material cooperation, as the harm to the victim would be genuinely a foreseen side effect. However, this is not the situation in the example of the servant. He would not be holding a ladder under a girl's window under cover of darkness unless it were part of a crime. Now, it may be helpful at this point to suggest an example of clearly material cooperation by way of comparison. Perhaps Dr. Samuel Mudd will serve the purpose. He was asked to fix the leg of John Wilkes Booth. He foresaw that this would facilitate the escape of Lincoln's assassin. Ignoring for the moment certain factors that cast doubt on Mudd's sympathies, we will assume that he did not set the leg with this goal in mind, finis operantis. Moreover, and critically, the fixing of a broken leg is not bad in itself. It is something that a doctor would do anyway, even if it were not going to contribute to an evil. Consequently, it qualifies as material cooperation. For a more prosaic example, some people wonder if they should continue to shop at Target or Starbucks or go to Disney World or patronize some similar establishment, knowing that some part of the profits will go towards promoting morally objectionable policies. The political activism of the company is not a reason for the person in question to be a client, which would obviously be formal cooperation, but rather a disincentive. Some people still have scruples about giving dollars to an entity which will give some of the cents on each dollar to an evil cause. Still, The fact that the person would have paid for those services anyway, regardless of whether a contribution would be made to an evil project, makes it material cooperation only. And this brings us to the end of the second part of my talk. I began by briefly summarizing the general argument of my book, and then we examined in greater detail the key question of the intentionality of a cooperator under duress. There remains the third part, an attempt to make some progress on still murky aspects. And there's one problem in particular which seems most urgent. We have criticized the intention-foresight distinction as it is ordinarily presented for being too clumsy, and have demanded that a third category be included, oblique intention or intentional but not intended, between what is intended and what is merely foreseen. We argued that many things are obliquely intended and so fall under the intention in some way, but that this intention does not signify, for purposes of moral evaluation, if it is legitimately subsumed under the governing intention of the agent. But here's the problem. It does not seem always easy to know when this obtains. The case of the prepaid embezzling secretary and that of Dr. Mudd are similar in that the evil is neither desired nor needed for the cooperator to obtain his end. Yet they are very different, clear cases, respectively, of formal and material cooperation. But the question is not often so clear. It can be difficult to know whether the action contemplated by the cooperator is one which he would do anyway, one that is per se ordered to his legitimate further intentions. Some may question, for instance, my earlier claim that holding the ladder for his master under the window of the victim is not something that the servant could consider part of his normal duties. It could be argued that servants are to do all manner of such tasks as holding ladders at odd hours without interesting themselves in their master's business. This seems to be a problem especially for cooperation in the workplace, as most jobs do have a generally legitimate purpose. At a certain point, it does seem that the generally legitimate character of a person's work allows the foreseen contribution to evil to be considered accidental. In my book, I mentioned in a footnote the case of a mailman who realizes that a certain item he delivers with some regularity is pornographic material, but not such as to be prohibited by the mail system. Does he do wrong to deliver it? I sought to exculpate the mailman by distinguishing his situation from that of a policeman asked to arrest pro-life trespassers, which I had earlier censured. I quote from my book, "It may be argued that the mailman's job to deliver packages without assessing their content is to deliver packages without assessing their content, just as a policeman's job is to take away trespassers without assessing their motives for trespassing. However, there must be a point, difficult as it may be to define abstractly, at which people may not claim to be just doing their job, a point at which their actions no longer correspond to their job, which is noble in itself, facilitating communications for a mailman or keeping the peace for a policeman. One avenue that may help distinguish the two cases, the mailman's cooperation seems to be legitimately classifiable as an omission. He omits removing the offensive piece from his bag or from the recipient's pile of mail. It is perhaps inaccurate to characterize his cooperation positively as delivering pornographic material. The policeman's action, on the other hand, arresting trespassers, is not readily described as an omission," end quote. The same critic cited earlier found my argument, quote, unconvincing, and I am inclined to agree with her. Right. It was only a footnote. She points out that, quote, "presenting as a mere omission to remove from his mailbag the delivery of morally offensive mail by a postman," see, she's English, postman, "merely raises further questions." So I will close then by making another attempt at exculpating the mailman. By way of reminder, what is needed, in my view, is not an appeal to the subject, for they are all, servant, secretary, policeman, and mailman, presumed to have no desire to contribute to the evils in question. Rather, what is needed is an objective reason in the nature of the actions that allows an agent to choose to contribute to the evil while credibly subsuming that choice under a good further intention. At the risk of multiplying examples, let me suggest the following pair of employees at a large drugstore. One has to move boxes about and put them on shelves. Some of these boxes contain condoms. The other employee handles tools and is asked to put up one of those dispensers of condoms that one sees occasionally outside of pharmacies, especially in Europe. Now, both of these employees, we presume, have a repugnance to contribute in any way to the diffusion of contraception, but both are de facto doing just that. Many commentators would conclude, rashly, as I've argued, that their cooperation is material because they offer it only to keep their jobs, and would then proceed to counsel the latter employee to put up greater resistance since his cooperation is more proximate. However, I would like to ask whether it is not possible, and also necessary, to distinguish their contributions on an objective basis in light of the analysis made above of the natural ordination, or lack thereof, of the actions chosen to the legitimate ends of the employees. This requires asking for real descriptions of what they are doing, not self-serving ones, which emphasize their finis operantis exclusively. Can the first employee claim that he is merely moving drugstore goods, such that the occasional moving of immoral items would be accidental? Remember, we wish to avoid saying that he could intend to put an item on the shelf which is clearly a contraceptive while not intending to put a contraceptive on the shelf, as if by merely directing his intention, he could qualify for material cooperation. Rather, we ask, could he choose to put the contraceptive on the shelf as a means per se ordered to his legitimate end of fulfilling his duties at the store? More to the point, could something about the second employee's action prevent him from making the same claim? Is there some difference in his action such that he would have to admit that he was doing something which was not of its nature ordered to a legitimate end? I would like to suggest that the answer is yes. It seems that the nature of the activity of a stock boy or a cashier is to handle many items quickly, noticing the nature of the item is not part of the job, just as a letter carrier is not supposed to consider the content of the mail. The question of the morality of their job choice should arise before taking the job. Working at a video store which rents a large percentage of pornographic videos, for instance, would be a different case. By contrast, the handyman, who is asked to put up the dispenser, seems to be asked to engage in a task that is not an ordinary part of his duties, foreseen when he was hired. Perhaps this distinction is borne out by the fact that it would be fairly easy to give the handyman a conscience exception, getting someone else to put up the machine, while the same is not the case for the other sort of employee. We recall, from St. Thomas's classic analysis of self-defense, that proportion is key to assessing the legitimacy of choosing the lethal defense. Is it proportionate to the end, or is it excessive? This may not always be an easy call to make. Still, it does seem plausible that the size of the task of putting up the dispenser, something which he is asked to do but once, which has a permanent and significant role in the evil, stands out from the normal work of the handyman in a disproportionate way. The suggestion, then, is that a mailman can claim to be delivering pornography without the intentionality required for formal cooperation, while a delivery man for a pornographic video store, if such a job exists, could not. Admittedly, such a distinction would not be easy to identify or to describe, and one cannot expect agreement upon the assessment of such cases. However, this should not prove that the distinction does not exist. Many other distinctions, such as the line between generosity and prodigality, legitimate deception and lying, stylish dress and immodesty, are also inevitably debatable. Perhaps this is why Professor Livio Molina suggests that the virtue of prudence will be needed to identify formal cooperation. he writes, quote, "It belongs to the virtue of prudence to grasp the context in which one acts and thus to recognize the intrinsic intentional traits of the action which objectively determine its identity," end quote. This confirms the claim that there is an intrinsic and objective distinction to be found between formal and material cooperation, although perhaps only a very prudent person could identify some cases in which cooperation is never, under any circumstances, to be given. Thank you.
So the servant, it formally cooperates with the master when he puts up the ladder.
According to me.
Okay, and if he permit, is it then always immoral for him to do that, or is that a matter of proportion? Like whether he just lose his job and be blackballed by masters, or whether, let's say, it's vindictive and he killed him and his whole family? Does that enter in, is it simply ruled out, or are there?
I would think simply ruled out. Yeah, I mean, if it really is something that. If it really does qualify as formal cooperation, then it would be ruled out under any circumstance, yes.
Thank you for your presentation. It was very, very interesting. To the servant and the ladder, part of formal cooperation depends upon the aim of the principal agent being fulfilled. But it seems to me that the servant's aim could be just as happily fulfilled if the master had a sudden conversion. Three quarters of the way into the girl's bedroom, he's struck by horror at his misdeed, and he voluntarily undertakes a life of penance on that very moment and comes down the ladder and says, "I'm so sorry." Is the servant frustrated? No, the servant is rejoicing. So the fulfillment of the harm to the girl wasn't really integral to the servant's proposal, right? And that would seem to save it from the informal cooperation. That's a question.
Yeah. Well, that's what I understand to be Germaine Grisé's position. That it would only be formal cooperation for the servant if the success of the master's plan was needed for the servant to obtain his end of protection, of, you know, continuation of his job or life.
So for Grisé, the servant comes under material rather than formal cooperation?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know
that
he actually...
I agree with that.
I mean,
okay.
Yeah.
Can I follow up? And so a principle of double effect, you don't rule that out. That would be always just material. Would that be material, or what happens there? The effects in 10 hives... Do you not see a tension there? I guess I don't have a great example.
With the double effect in the case of the servant?
Well, I wouldn't look at the double effect,
I think usually people think, you know, would justify cooperation with evil using the double effect. I think they would see the facilitation of the master's plan as the evil and unintended effect, and the good effect being saving your life or job, and say what the claim would be, that what I'm actually doing is not bad, holding a ladder, and if there's proportionality, so her situation or my life, then it would be a legitimate case of double effect. I think that'd be a typical argument, but not one that I would follow, because first of all, it seems that what is actually being done is not indifferent. You know that, but also this is a case that's been that is pointed to as where the double effect doesn't seem to be working, because the good effect sought follows from the bad effect. So again, aside from the fact that it might not actually have to come off, but ordinarily, in the ordinary course of things, you're doing something ordained to the bad effect, and so that help, so that contribution to the harm that's going to normally ensue, causing that harm was necessary for you to not be fired, let's say. So most people, I mean, at least it's often referred to as an example, corruption of evil in general, as an example of when the double effect, that condition that the good effect shouldn't follow from the evil effect doesn't obtain.
But he wouldn't be punished, as you said. So if the girl's not there for some reason, fortunately, the master would still be wouldn't take it out on the servant because the servant held the ladder. So it's really holding the ladder. It's not derivative on the violation of the girl necessarily, right? It's derivative on I told you to hold the ladder. You held the ladder. Okay, whatever happens after that.
Well, here the evil effect of her suffering is more removed from what the servant does than in the case of the merchant, where, you know, throwing the stuff overboard and it getting ruined is rather proximate. But my position would be that it's still, because it's a per se effect that it normally or frequently occurs, like the mudding of the shoes, or like I said, the fading of the curtains might miraculously not happen, but these are things that ordinarily follow from what you're doing, and therefore they have to be considered part of your intention in this secondary sense.
Could you analyze under the situation of a nurse cooperating in not a craniotomy but in a hysterectomy, which is ordered to, you know, remove cancers? It seems that your argument assumes that that causal linkages are important, but there's a clear causal link between the action of the surgeon in removing the cancerous uterus and the death of the fetus, right? And so the nurse cooperating with the doctor would then seem to be formally cooperating in the death of the fetus.
Yeah, When I say that it will be material if it's something you're going to do anyway, I think I'm maybe in more informal language trying to say what Dr. Long was saying, that if there is the legitimate purpose, the governing intention for that action is to remove the cancerous uterus, save the life of the woman, regardless of whether there is it's accidental to that, or whether there is a fetus present or not. So for that reason, your morally the moral description, the moral object is that helpful medical intervention.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, Father, thanks for your remarks. I wanted to ask you, sort of viva voce, if you think that this sort of tripartite terminology is reasonable here. In other words, most formal with respect to the end because of its formally maximal causality in the act, formal because Thomas uses this language of the object of the external act and the species as formal, and then material with respect to that which is indirect. Because this constant need to divide the Red Sea between the formal and the material seems not adequately to bring in all of the things that you're trying to bring in with respect to the ordering with the end as most causal and the object of the external act is still formally defining. I'm just asking, do you think this terminological move is helpful, or is it simply wholly secondary? In other words, you still have to make the same distinctions.
The what's the tripart distinction again? The tripart
most formal co-op. Does this work?
Yeah.
You can hear me.
Oh, I can hear you.
Fascinating. most formal with respect to the shared intention of the end. Formal when what is involved is integral or essential cooperation with respect to the object of the external act. Material with respect to an indirect or peripheral causality.
No, it does. I certainly didn't bring that up in my work, but some kind of distinction like that does seem helpful. Because, yeah, and it, just, it could be that also would lead to maybe as you say, getting away from treating cooperation with evil in such a dramatic way, either formal and never able to under any circumstances, or material impossible. It could be that there's a third category also there.
Just for my own clarification, does that terminology correspond in your view to formal cooperation, implicit formal cooperation, and material cooperation?
I think it would.
So it's just, that would seem then just to be a question of the label, but the distinction would be effectively the same.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, that's helpful.
But my question was just to follow up on that. And so are you saying, it's two questions. Are you saying, first of all, then that, what was the language you just gave? I'm having trouble talking about this tomorrow.
Most formal, and material, that's long.
Yeah.
And Cummings is formal, implicitly formal, and material.
Okay, yeah. Right.
Or explicitly formal.
Okay, so formal cooperation is always an intrinsically evil, correct?
Right.
Implicit formal cooperation is not.
No, would also be.
Would also.
Yeah.
Okay. But you also still have approximate and non-proximate material cooperation distinction, or do the proximate collapse into the...
No, you do. The materials would stay the way it is, and actually the... In the later chapters of my book, I tried to argue for a proximate and remote distinction in the formal as well.
Okay. That, and then finally, so
Which would make some formal cooperation merely venial sin.
Okay.
You know,
formal cooperation is always wrong.
Correct.
But I take it that distinction then no longer tracks an intentional not all intentional. Cooperation counts as formal of either sort of formal cooperation anymore.
Well, it's always intentional in that it's a human act.
Right.
But the question is whether your intention is coinciding with that of the principal agent.
Okay. And if it does, if it's intentional but doesn't coincide,
then it's material. Then it's material.
And not material.
Uh-huh.
It's not formal of either kind.
If you're
implicitly formal.
If you in no way share the evil intention of the principal agent, it would be material. It would be explicitly formal if you shared the intention of the if the servant wanted to harm that girl, that would be formal, explicitly formal, or formal in the greatest possible sense, the most formal. Because he fully shares the end of the principal agent. But if he doesn't share that end at all, but is doing something which has, but nonetheless the same, if the per se effects of what he's choosing for his own purposes are harmful to the girl, directly harmful to the girl, then that would be implicitly formal, and also in some sense sharing the evil intention of the master.
Okay. Now, I'm sure it's just my inability to track all the... I'm trying to see how intentional maps on, the different kinds of intentional action map onto the different kinds of formal cooperation.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
I think maybe just a question. I mean, as I'm listening to you have this exchange, I'm wondering if there's some confusion or equivocation in the way we're using the word intention or intentional. And I'd be curious to hear all of you comment on that, because it seems to me that often we say, oh, well, what's the intention of the act or the intention of the act or something like that. But the terminology, at least that Dr. Long was talking about, was you have the end, the finis operantis, the end of the actor. Then you have the object of the action, the object of the external act, the finis operis. And then now you're talking about sharing the intention, which might be either of these in a certain sense. Like you might share the end. You might intend the end of the master. You want to see the master accomplish what he's aiming at.
Which is, in case of duress, it's not.
Yeah, or you might just intend the end of the act. You intend to do the external act, and therefore, even though you don't like it, you're actually embracing
right.
the finis operis.
Right.
And if that is an evil, because understanding that what you're doing with putting a ladder up against the building requires you to understand what's happening here, then you have to say, well, you're actually intending the evil, even though you don't like it and you don't share the finis operantis of the principal agent. Your
right.
finis operantis is to save my job.
Right.
Or whatever. Is that so?
And that's what we would call implicitly formal.
Is it correct, then, that we're using intention in various different ways in this? Or is
yeah.
it, I mean, should we purify our language of intention? Maybe that's
well, yeah, there's, I was a little bit alluding to that by saying, you know, there's the normal paradigmatic sense where this is, you're doing this because of, let's say, the positive contribution it makes to my goal. And then there's this other sense where I'm doing something which intentionally, which has certain effects which I foresee and which not only foresee but which always or frequently follow from this object that I'm choosing. And so that falls under the intention or is intentional or indirectly intended in some way.
Did you agree to talk about it? In the case that Father John Baptist brought up early on, questions about if there's sort of extreme circumstances where it's not only a matter of saving the job, but a matter of saving one's family's life so lives are being threatened. It seems like is this correct that you'd want to say that this, even though the person, the servant, would still be intending, so intended act and therefore implicitly cooperating, that you could say, though, that his culpability, right, would be greatly diminished.
Oh, sure.
Situation.
Oh, sure.
Even though it's a grave, you would argue that it's a grave matter when he's doing it gravely wrong, the culpability.
Sure. Not only that, yes, I definitely would say that. That, and his culpability and that of many people who are in these difficult situations where they're asked to do something which they can see as a positive, is a real contribution to an evil, and maybe just they're doing a small thing, but they have great reasons to do it because they would lose their job or whatever. It's their culpability certainly might be reduced, but also in an extreme situation like that, it seems a little bit like the case of which I had to mention in one part of the treatment. Of lying to protect people who would be killed, like during World War II, that sort of thing. Those very difficult situations where you're being asked to do something. Maybe I shouldn't bring up. I know it's a can of worms, the lying thing, but where you're if you are being asked to do something that's clearly intrinsically wrong, even a small intrinsic evil to save some, to avoid some very great evil, that it's. That happens in other situations as well, and the only thing one can really hope for is either some inspiration where there's a third choice you can come up with, or the person might choose to do the intrinsic evil and under reduced culpability, and we have to say, well, he didn't find a better way out. But to posit that there's only two ways out is a bit of a imaginary artificial construct.
This is still asking for clarification. I'm just trying to get up. So if we have a notion of intention in the strict sense, right, encompassing simply what you take to be your end and then what you take to be the means insofar as it's beneficial for obtaining the end, then you think that the servant need not intend the wrong that the master is doing by bringing over the left. Right? So the servant doesn't intend the violation of the woman as an end, and also doesn't intend the violation of the woman as a means, right? That could also be the case, right? Perhaps the servant thinks he's going to get something out of the fact that the woman violated him, so it's a mere means, but still intended. So it's So in the strict sense, not intended, but in this other sense that sometimes you call intentional, and sometimes you say, you use Steve's language of following as a per se effect from some particular activity, then in that broader sense of intended, there is a sharing of intention, yes, there's a form of cooperation. Is that correct so far?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I was really trying to say that it is a means, just that it would be too narrow to define means as the way Dr. Gizet did, as some kind of positive contribution, but that it's a means because his end is to save his job. The means is to do something that directly harms or ordinarily ensues in harm for the Virgin. So I was trying to include it rather as a means that is intended, but in this, but in as all means, as something that, if it is per se ordered to a legitimate end, would be subsumed under that to have that species.
So you think. At the same time, both of this, that the violation of the woman does not make a positive contribution to the servant's ends. Right? The servant wants to survive. Let's make the worst case scenario. Right? He thinks that his master will kill him.
Yeah.
And the question in his mind is, how can I make sure that I don't get killed? And you think that it's true that the violation of the woman does not make a positive contribution to that goal. The goal of is not
being killed. Yeah. The actual effect that normally would follow is not necessary, but the doing of a thing that generally will have that effect is necessary. That's what makes the positive contribution.
When you say that, the doing of the thing that will have that effect generally is necessary. What is the doing of that thing? What does that refer to?
Holding the ladder. Holding the ladder.
Okay, so this is the question that I would like clarification of. In what way is holding the ladder something as its per se effect, or is intrinsically ordained to, or in any other sense, has as its ordinary fulfillment the violation of something, right? I mean, there's any number of different things that you could carry the ladder for, or that the master might want the ladder.
But holding a ladder under, this is where you have to get into the circumstances affecting the object. And if you're holding a ladder for the master under the window of the girl at night, then it's not just holding a ladder. That would be a self-serving description of the object.
Can I just one more thing? So then it looks like any time that the agent in question, not the cooperator, but the primary agent, specifies a purpose, an ultimate purpose for which he's going to do something, and identifies that purpose for the cooperator, right, and says, now I want you to do this other thing, that's going to help me to accomplish that purpose, right? Or X, Y, or Z may ensue, right? That it's in virtue of identifying the purpose that this thing here that you're being asked to do, drive me to the store so I can buy some pornography, move the ladder so that I can engage in this horrible act, right? That it's in virtue of specifying the purpose that the doing of this particular thing becomes identifiable as a per se means towards that purpose. I'm just
trying
to understand your position. Does that adequately characterize the view that you're expressing?
I think so.
Let's thank Monsignor Cummings for his very fine.